Come to order, everyone, please. Good afternoon. Welcome to the May 31st, 2012 meeting. This is a special meeting of the Washington Fish and Wildlife Commission to look specifically at one item, and that is main stem Columbia River fisheries. So this is a workshop that is in response to commission request, that we begin the process of refamiliarizing ourselves with the complexity of the Columbia River fisheries. Quite a few of the members of the commission at this point were not involved in previous efforts to provide briefings on Columbia River fisheries, so this is the beginning of an education process for them, and it's just going to be a refresher for those of us who went through the last policy development relation to spring Chinook and summer Chinook. So thanks very much, staff, for all your hard work in putting this lengthy document together. Looking forward to this briefing. Also want to let my fellow commissioners know that this is going to be a pretty long briefing. We've just got one break scheduled in, 3 o'clock. If you need more breaks, just let us know. There are going to be opportunities as speakers change and the subject changes to call a break if you want. The other thing is, since this is, for our purposes, this is a workshop, we don't have any other items on the agenda, I want you to feel free to be interactive with staff. This is for our learning purposes. So if you need to ask questions as they go along, feel free. But if your question anticipates information that they will later provide in a slide, staff are encouraged to just tell us, hold your horses, we'll get to it. So we don't use up too much time going back and forth with information. So, okay. Thanks very much. Director Anderson, do you want to introduce the subject at all, or staff?
Well, I went over the blue sheet again that was submitted by Commissioner Mankin back in February that leads up to this presentation, and it was indeed comprehensive of a lot of the fishery management issues and species that are part of our management responsibility in the Columbia River. And believe it or not, there used to be more slides than what you see now. This has been pared down, I think, to 199, I think was the last count. But it is it's a comprehensive overview, and obviously there are specific fisheries within this overview, summer Chinook, spring Chinook, that you may want to have us come back and talk about specifically in some more detail and more depth. So think of this as a somewhat measured drink out of a fire hydrant, and to the best of our ability, that covers the breadth of issues and fisheries that we're all responsible for in the Columbia River. And then at the end of the briefing today, I'd like to have a discussion about, okay, here's a pretty comprehensive overview of all the various aspects of our responsibilities in the Columbia River from a fisheries perspective. Are there pieces of this? Are there specific fisheries or species that you'd like us to come back and dig deeper into? But given the breadth of the topic that we're trying to cover here, we're going to get down into it a bit, but we're not there's a limit as to how deep we got into each one of the issues. So great, just a lot of work to put this together. Really want to thank all of these folks, plus those that helped that aren't here, in bringing this forward. And I believe, Bill, are you going to lead this off? And maybe you could just start by introducing your colleagues that are joining you, and then we'll get started.
Thank you, Director Anderson, and thank you, Chair Wecker and Commissioners. Yes, this is a refresher. I'm not sure you'll feel refreshed at the end of it, but please, Director Anderson made one of the major points that we wanted to make here, too, which is we don't anticipate this will be the end, but we'd like this to be to serve it. First off, the handouts that we've prepared to serve as a really good reference document for you over the years. So we sort of encourage you to hang on to that fairly thick packet. And we've got additional graphs and tables that can be provided. We can certainly go into additional depth at your choosing for future dates. So the panel who's we've assembled to provide this presentation, I'm Bill Twight. I work in the director's office and I work on a broad range of Columbia River issues, have been engaged historically in harvest issues to a fairly great extent. I'm not doing that quite as much as I shift over more into Columbia River water and continuing work in Columbia River hydro issues, but Guy Norman and I still pair up on a lot of harvest issues. And I'm just going to let the rest of the panel briefly introduce themselves, and then we'll go over the outline of the talk. So to my right is Cindy LaFleur.
Cindy LaFleur, Columbia River Policy Coordinator, working in the Columbia River.
I'm Jeff Korth. I'm the Regional Fish Program Manager for Region 2 out of Ephrata. Cover things upstream of Priest Rapids Dam.
Hi, I'm John Easterbrooks. I'm the Regional Fish Program Manager in Region 3, South Central Washington. McNary to Priest Rapids, Hanford Reach.
Good afternoon. My name is John Whalen. I'm the Region 1 Fish Program Manager out of Spokane. So for the anadromous zone that we'll be talking about today, it's the Snake River, basically up including those areas that are on the borders between Oregon and Idaho.
So we've organized today's presentation to first off try to provide some historical perspective. In the Columbia River, history is extremely important and defines a lot of where we are today. Secondly, we wanted to give you a pretty good overview of what we call the rules of the road, which is a lot about who makes what decisions that affect Columbia River fisheries in particular, but we're going to continue to try to talk through that about how all the H's fit together in the Columbia. Third, then, begin to delve more into the details of fishery implementation, and then finally, we want to be able to walk you through to a fair extent the management of a lot of the different fisheries throughout the Columbia. And again, as the chair said, please feel free to ask us questions at any point, and we will let you know where we may be able to give you more information later and just ask you to hold your questions. But again, the idea is that we're going to start with sort of more of the general overview and end up looking at a lot more detail on a lot of these fisheries. There's several major themes that we hope come through to you fairly repeatedly and consistently through today's presentation. The first theme is that everything we do in the Columbia River is built around conservation and salmon recovery objectives, and it's all done in an all-age context. You can't increase or decrease harvest some without thinking about what does that mean in terms of hydro? What does that mean in terms of how we operate our hatcheries? What does that mean in terms of how we're doing at our habitat objectives that are defined through our salmon recovery plans? These are all absolutely interrelated. And if, for instance, we were to fall down on any one of these obligations, it means the other three have to pick up the slack in order to stay on track. They all play a role. They all play a part. And so all of our fishery decisions are made in an all-age context. That's one reason that this is a very complex environment that we operate in the Columbia. Another reason is just it's a very, very multi-jurisdictional fishery, both in terms of adjoining states, in terms of our relationships with our tribal co-managers, as well as with the federal government, both through ESA, but also through administration of the Magnuson-Stevens Act, and then even with Canada through the Pacific Salmon Treaty, and we'll try and give you a sense of that. But if nothing else, we want to impress you with just how complex it is. We also want to impress you with the diverse range of fishing opportunities that we really work hard to try to achieve. No one fishery really should be viewed as the most important fishery in the Columbia or outside of the Columbia. A lot of our outside fisheries are absolutely dependent on Columbia River fish, and that all these fisheries as well have to share in achieving the conservation objectives. And finally, as you'll note, I think through the final section where we describe a lot of the individual fisheries, the passage of the Columbia River Salmon and Steelhead endorsement really has provided us with a powerful tool for providing a lot of new sport fishing opportunities. And we're, as staff, really excited about that. So here's the basin. Well, actually, most of the basin. Just a brief reminder that our neighbor to the north, Canada, actually manages a large part of the basin and a very large part of the total runoff. But for our purposes today, we will be primarily focused on the U.S. portion of the basin as we describe various fisheries. The black dots that you can see there are the major dams. The influence of hydro is indeed truly pervasive throughout the basin. The first impassable dams, and I should have a laser pointer and don't, but the first impassable dam on the Columbia River is Chief Joseph Dam, which is the second black dot on the main stem Columbia down from the border, the upper black dot being Grand Coulee. And again, from a historical context, that's very important. And on the salmon, the first impassable dam is Brownlee Dam, and that's just downstream of the junction there between the salmon and the snake in Idaho. So as you can see, the amount of anadromous access to the basin has been curtailed substantially over time. Before hydro development, before contact, salmon migrated 1,200 miles into Canada, so even further than they currently migrate in the Fraser, on a par with how far they migrate in the Yukon River. This truly was one of the great rivers of the Northwest, and 600 miles into Idaho. And that is still the longest journey, the journey of the Snake River, sockeye make up into the Redfish Lake Basin. Extremely important source of food for tribes throughout the basin prior to European arrival. The largest fishery occurred at Celilo. The fishery at Kettle Falls was almost as large. Those two areas were geographically the single most important economic and major trading locations in all of the Pacific Northwest. It's likely that over time, virtually every interior tribal member at some point, they or their family visited either Celilo or Kettle Falls. They were that important. Traveled for over thousands of miles. As you're aware, Kettle Falls is now completely inundated behind Grand Coulee and no longer accessible. Celilo Falls is inundated but still has salmon, and that's just upstream of the Dalles Dam. Salmon were an absolutely essential food resource. It's well documented that during periods of salmon scarcity, that was often the cause for famine, disease outbreaks, etc. Their health really was integral with the Columbia River salmon health. Commercial fishing in the Columbia became significant almost 150 years ago, or almost exactly 150 years ago. Canneries began to operate shortly after the first fisheries, and within just over 50 years, the annual harvest had achieved very, very high totals, 25 to 45 million pounds, 600,000 Chinook, for instance. And that's even after, that final statistic is even after Grand Coulee Dam went in, which was the first major loss of Chinook production in the river. A very large part of the summer Chinook spawned above Coulee. The development of the hydro system began prior to World War II. Grand Coulee was one of the first and remains the single largest impact still to salmon. Over 500 miles of habitat loss. The estimates of the loss just for two primary species, sockeye and summer Chinook, range anywhere from 5 to 15 million annually. Huge losses. All those areas that are now dammed reservoirs in Canada were formerly excellent sockeye lakes prior to damming. Brownlee and the Snake went in 58. And then there was that whole period from the mid-30s until the completion of the four lower Snake dams in the late 60s when the Army Corps of Engineers and others were extremely busy building dams in the Columbia, including the five PUD dams operated by three different PUDs under FERC jurisdiction. All the rest of the dams, though, were built under congressional mandates, built by either the Army Corps or the Bureau of Reclamation. Just give you a quick chronology, then, of some of the major fishery events, starting with the signing of the treaties back in 1855. Those treaties were signed between the United States and what we call the four treaty tribes, the Nez Perce, the Warm Springs, the Umatillas, and the Yakimas, and also a treaty was signed with the Shoshone-Bannocks, a somewhat different treaty, but still offering fishing rights. After that came executive orders, and many of the other tribes that we deal with in the Columbia River are executive order tribes. In 1918, Congress recognized that the management of Columbia River stocks depended on the ability of the states to cooperate and coordinate, and gave us permission to jointly regulate interstate commerce. As you know, typically that's something that Congress reserves to themselves, is the authority to regulate interstate commerce. But in order to ensure the orderly management of fisheries, Congress gave to the states of Oregon and Washington the ability to convene a compact and do that. And that's still, that, like the treaties, still is a very major institution in how we manage the river nowadays. The first recognition of the need for mitigation for dam construction was in 1937, when Congress passed the Mitchell Act, and we began to construct some hatcheries. We don't cover all the different mitigation attempts in this chronology, but again, just to give you a sense of, we saw even back then that the advent of the dams would certainly have an impact on the salmon runs, but we clearly as well had very different expectations about the success of the mitigation. We really did not begin to actively reduce seasons in order to achieve conservation objectives until 1943. So we've been fishing for a long time, almost 80 years, before we moved away from simply setting seasons and letting them go. 1960 was the advent of really the first of the outside fisheries. Prior to then, all Columbia River harvest impacts happened in the river, in the system. But in 1960, we began to support ocean fisheries. And in part, that's due to the success of many of the Mitchell Act hatcheries, providing a lot of fish, a lot of additional fish for ocean harvest. Relating back to the treaties, the very first litigation that began to provide us guidance on how to enmesh the treaties with our interpretations of state law, 1968, the first federal court judgment on the U.S. v. Oregon. In 1973, the Endangered Species Act was passed by Congress, and even though our first listings didn't happen until quite a while later, this is certainly laying the seeds. As you can see, it was, again, almost 20 years before the first ESA listings, and that's now another one of our dominant institutional impacts. And finally, most recently, one of many sort of what we call 10-year agreements that have given us, switched us out of a mode of fairly active negotiation through a lot of the last decade, and now this decade we're spending a lot of time on implementing these various agreements. One of them was the U.S. v. Oregon 10-year harvest agreement. So switching now to giving you something of an overview of the rules of the road. And by this we mean all the different sets of guidance in some cases, and in some cases court orders or federal mandates through ESA that we have to work within as we craft fishing opportunities. And again, I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about how many of these have a large role outside of harvest. We're beginning to focus in some on harvest, but in most of these cases, these things affect a lot more than harvest, or are closely interrelated with a lot more than harvest. So even though our talk will be a little bit more focused on harvest, I want you to keep in mind that when we're talking about harvest, we've thought about how these biological opinions fit in with, say, the federal hydropower biological opinion, how they fit in with the salmon recovery plans that have been developed by the Washington State Salmon Recovery Boards and adopted by the feds, how they fit in with our hard work at reforming hatcheries, and that if we don't stay on track with hatchery reform, a lot of our harvest objectives will not be fulfilled. So there's a lot of those side stories, and again, they're not side stories to us. They're extremely important, but if we were to try to do all that today, too, I'm afraid we'd go probably through the night, actually. So we are going to try and focus in more on harvest, but don't hear that as that's our focus. Hear that as us just trying to provide some detail here. First, and for a long time, has been foremost in as providing guidance is the ongoing U.S. v. Oregon litigation. As you saw, it started in 1968. It is still an active court case. We still fairly regularly receive guidance from the court on difficult issues. We still negotiate all of our management plans and most of our hatchery production plans under the supervision of the U.S. v. Oregon court. And all of our agreements end up being entered in as court orders. The ESA, starting in the early 1990s, has just continued to increase in importance and in terms of its impact on how we manage fisheries every year since then. And in recent years, the ability to pair up important documents like the biological opinion on the Federal Columbia River Power System, that's a paired document with the biological opinion on the 10-year U.S. v. Oregon Harvest Agreement. The two depend on each other. The mortality rates that are examined in the hydropower biological opinion assume a certain set of harvest actions and harvest mortality rates, and vice versa. And finally, the recovery plans as well are contingent on us achieving a certain set of harvest objectives. Those recovery plans are contingent on us also meeting our goals for improving survival through the hydro system, et cetera. Your policies that you adopt, often in consultation with the Oregon Commission, provide extremely important guidance as well, not just in terms of allocation itself and allocation between commercial and recreational or allocation between upriver and downriver recreational fisheries, but also in terms of you provide us guidance as well on synthesizing our harvest management actions with hatchery reform. You provide us with guidance on managing bycatch and other things as well. So they provide a very important set of guidelines for us. Switching from what some of the goalposts are then to who the parties are, there are many, many, many parties. We still, as states and tribes, like to think of ourselves as the primary day-to-day managers of harvest, even though we do that within ESA constraints, we do that within lots of other constraints, but we're still the active day-to-day managers, and we want to continue that way. We think that's an extremely important role for the states and tribes. So we share what we call co-management responsibilities, both in the tributaries and in the main stem river, although in both cases it's often making sure that the agreements that we arrive at will pass federal muster. Commissioner Perry?
Yeah. Is this done mainly through the North of Falcon process?
I will get to that a little bit more. I'll describe a little bit more about some of the different arenas that we use to work together, and then Cindy will describe that in a fair amount more detail. Again, just a reminder then of what our statutory authorities are or what our legal authorities are in our roles as managers. The tribal treaties for the treaty tribes reserve their rights not only to fish in perpetuity, but also to control their destiny over their fisheries. And then you're all fairly familiar, I believe, with the state laws that establish that you and the Department of Fish and Wildlife as the primary managers for what we call the public's fish. U.S. v. Oregon provides us with a lot of clarification then on exactly how to interpret the treaties and that reserved property right that the tribes have. And then finally, as I've mentioned several times, our friends in the federal government are happy to share their ESA thoughts with us. The U.S. v. Oregon court case, the ruling little different than the U.S. v. Washington ruling, but fundamentally the same legal grounds. The two court cases have a few notable differences, but on all the basic legal principles, they're identical. So you'll, by and large, if you know U.S. v. Washington, you'll understand U.S. v. Oregon pretty quickly, and vice versa. Similar to U.S. v. Washington, everything revolves around the management plans that the parties have negotiated. Our management plan in U.S. v. Oregon tends to be a little more prescriptive. The U.S. v. Washington management plan is a little more programmatic. The U.S. v. Oregon management plan first was adopted in 1988, and then we've periodically revised and updated those management plans. From the beginning, though, the parties have recognized the importance of beginning the planning effort with agreements on what constitutes conservation and setting those conservation levels. And because in the Columbia, we already, even prior to ESA, recognized we had several very weak stocks, and again, you'll get a lot of the history on these stocks as we go through it later. We began by developing agreement on how to achieve rebuilding on those. So the principles were for rebuilding the upriver runs and fairly sharing the harvest and protecting the weak stocks as we do it. We're currently operating under a 10-year agreement that will extend through 2017 that is our most sensitive agreement yet in terms of fluctuating harvest with abundance, and that's because we've gained the tools to do that much better over time. We've also gained the understanding of the need to have our harvest management principles fit with the hydro management principles, fit with the salmon recovery plans, etc. Parties to U.S. v. Oregon, the states of Washington, Oregon, Idaho, the federal government through two different agencies, U.S. Fish and Wildlife and National Marine Fisheries Service, the tribes that I've mentioned, and then other federal participants include Bureau of Indian Affairs and Department of Justice. So a little bit more on the Endangered Species Act. More than just salmonids are listed. We also have listed green sturgeon, bull trout, and eulachon. You can see the extent of the geographical extent of the listings nowadays, and here these are just the salmon listings, not bull trout as well. If we were to show bull trout also, it would be really every corner of the basin. And you can see, to some extent here on the graphic, some of the diversity. There's one chum run down low. That's that fish with the purplish bars on the side. You see the one listed sockeye, the bright red fish with the green head in Idaho. And then you can see an intermingling of steelhead and Chinook listings, and as well there's a coho listing down low. But most areas have listed fish. Some areas have only one species, like the Yakima drainage. Other areas have multiple species, like the snake. Even though we're not going to cover the Columbia River Power System biop in detail in this, again, I can't emphasize the importance and the interrelatedness of this document to our harvest documents. We were an active participant in negotiating that, and we were an active participant for several reasons. One, we wanted to ensure through an all-H approach that every H equitably bears the burden so that the hydro folks don't try to just push all the responsibility off onto harvest, and then obviously we know it runs the other way as well. Secondly, we wanted to make sure that the mitigation efforts that were going to be included in the Federal Columbia River BIOP include funding of a broad range of H's, not just focused on the hydro alone, but that it would provide funding for implementing our salmon recovery plans through habitat, provide some funding to assist us with hatchery reform, provide some funding for us to develop new tools for harvest management and new tools for harvest itself, as well as including predation. It describes the roles of the parties in monitoring. We believe that the BIOP is a well-crafted BIOP, but it is based on a set of scientific assumptions. We felt that those are mostly reasonable assumptions. You could have made other assumptions, and in order to test out which assumptions are correct, requires monitoring and requires adaptive management. We believe we have a very important role as a monitor. And then again, with recovery plans, I think as most of you know, those are generally locally developed, but they and most of the work has been done on developing the plans the salmon recovery boards are now implementing. But even though that's done at a local level, it's all of those plans have to recognize the impacts, the downstream impacts of the hydro system, have to recognize the impacts that poorly operated hatcheries have had, has to recognize the downstream impacts of harvest, but also need to be built around the benefits of harvest. We've found that one of the best ways for keeping these local salmon recovery boards doing the extremely hard work of salmon recovery is it's pretty nice when you get to fish in your backyard instead of having to drive all the way down to the lower river for a fishery. And so including, and you'll hear a lot more about our work at providing fisheries in terminal areas, but again, the recovery plans don't contemplate just control of fisheries, they contemplate providing new fisheries as well, and that's really important. And then finally, our federal friends like to remind us that everything we do requires a permit.
Commissioner Schmidten.
Thank you, Chair. And Bill, if you don't mind, before we move into the commission and state section, I want to make sure I have the federal rules of the road really in mind. In on page 6, you had in 1968, the federal courts ruled equitable harvest. Does that differ from the Bolt language? Can you expand on what it means? What happens if you don't meet the equitable harvest?
We've never had quite the explicit specificity that Bolt provided, but the judges have made it clear over time that in the absence of the party's agreement, we should pretty much figure it's going to be 50-50, except that it's not 50-50 if under which parties should bear sort of the conservation burden necessity first. And there's usually a hint from the bench, and we've really tried hard to never get anything more than simply a hint from the bench, that if the judge were pushed to rule on a weak stock or to which party conservation necessity gets applied to first, the court would generally find in favor of the tribes. So it's 50-50, and we interpret it as 50-50, and most of our management plans are built around 50-50, but with the same recognition that we've gotten that we don't want to ever push too hard on who ESA applies to first, because we don't have any indication that at present that's a winning argument for us. It might be sometime in the future, but at present it doesn't look like it. And secondly, both courts have also made it clear that fish for ceremonial and subsistence purposes always comes first as well. So when you look at the spring Chinook agreement, that's an agreement that ensures that the tribes will achieve their ceremonial and subsistence goals before we begin to look at matching up on directed commercial and recreational harvest. And finally, also remember that our portion includes fish caught in the ocean as well, fish caught outside of the Columbia. So I didn't give you a completely straight answer, Commissioner.
Only the last piece, and that's what happens if the 50-50, what do we call it, equitable harvest is not met. Do you have any?
Sorry, that's my... That I've talked too long.
Yeah, and I'm signal. Yeah, but quickly, something on that piece. And
we don't have any direct equitable adjustment clauses. So typically what happens is we end up having to renegotiate the agreement itself in order to correct whatever deficiency. And if it's a single year, generally we're comfortable with each other's management well enough to know that happens. But if it's a multiple year problem in one party's view or another, we'll renegotiate. So we don't have to do the keeping tally. That is one of the salient differences between USV Washington and USV Oregon.
I just wanted to add that in some cases, neither parties get their 50%. Fall Chinook is an example because we're constrained by ESA requirements. So we keep track of how much we harvest towards our 50%, but neither non-Indians or treaty tribes ever get their 50% because of ESA.
So this is just a quick reminder of the various policy guidances that you've provided to us, and also sort of a not-so-subtle hint that you're going to be seeing a lot of us over the next year or two as several of these guidances expire, and we're going to be coming to you asking for renewed policy guidance. In general, these are policies that work best when you coordinate with the Oregon Commission and provide us joint or coordinated guidance that's at the least compatible. So there's the timing for this is excellent in terms of giving you an overview of our background for a lot of the issues that are going to be coming in front of you.
Commissioner Carpenter?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question, Cindy, about what you said, because we have a preseason planning process where the run size is forecast, and we know what the harvested amount available is in that run size prior to the season as it relates to ESA. So I don't understand why, help me to understand why nobody reaches a 50% of the harvestable amount after ESA is already set aside.
In the US v. Oregon agreement, I'm going to talk about this in a little bit, but basically ESA is more constraining than harvestable surplus. And if you didn't have ESA, there would be many more fish harvestable. But because of the mixed stock fisheries, you can't get at the harvestable numbers because the ESA fish are mixed in. So nobody has the ability to catch the fish that we should be able to catch because they're mixed in with the other fish. And so those are the harvestable numbers of fish that the tribes and we say, you know, absent ESA, those could be harvested. Now, if you just look at it in terms of ESA, then it's not a 50-50 sharing. It's a different formula then. And the other point to add to what Bill was saying was to get to Ms. Commissioner Schmitten's question. As long as we don't hinder each other from achieving each of the two groups' share, you know, it's okay. If we don't get our 50% or our share, or if the tribes don't get their 50% or their share, they don't blame us unless we hinder them from that. Does that help at all? But I think I'm going to get to a little bit of that.
Dr. Anderson?
Two things. One on that, it's almost like thinking about our hatchery surplus in Puget Sound. We can't harvest all the hatchery fish because of ESA constraints. It's the same general principle that we have harvestable numbers of hatchery fish in the Columbia River we can't get to because of the constraints of listed stocks. The other thing I just wanted to, I wasn't sure it was worth mentioning, but I think I will. And you don't have to go back to slide 11, but on slide 11, when you were talking about the management entities and the co-management relationship, you referenced the treaty right as being a property right. You used the term property right. And I think the treaty right, the reserved right, is the right to harvest fish, is to take fish. It isn't a property right, in my view. If I look at the treaty language, the reserved right for the tribes was to take fish in common with. And that has been interpreted, at least in Bolt, to mean 50% of the harvestable numbers. So there's a nuance there that I think is important.
And I apologize for that. What I did not mean to convey that the fish were property. They're clearly not. What I meant to convey was it was as property was exchanged, this was a right that remained. And that was my sort of shorthand version for the exchange of real estate. The tribes retained certain rights, and I
got you. Okay.
So a lot of our day-to-day bread and butter fishery management starts with the policy guidance that we receive from you and the director. And then as we try to implement that, we do that through a variety of decision-making bodies. We always do that as well by arranging public meetings through involving the public. You do that as part of developing your initial policy guidance, but the implementation stage involves as much consultation with the public, both through formalized advisory groups as well as through just any opportunity we have to get input and advice from constituents. And it takes a lot of work, but it's absolutely, it's your expectation, and it ultimately is far more successful for us. The key forums that we participate in order to implement the guidance that we get from you and in order to implement the range of harvest management actions that need to be taken in order to achieve our goals are very broad. I mentioned already that includes the international, includes the Pacific Salmon Treaty, and as well it includes the U.S. domestic ocean fisheries through the Pacific Fishery Management Council, includes USV Oregon, and then finally the states of Oregon and Washington collectively work through the compact. These are the key ones. There are others as well with a more minor influence, but these are the primary ones that we're engaged in essentially annually. So one of those forums, the 2000, is the USV Oregon. And again, as I mentioned, we're operating under a management agreement at present that extends through 2017. That management agreement provides us with the basic harvest guidelines for in-river fisheries for all salmonids. Virtually all of those are abundance-based now. They're not just a simple escapement goal, and everything above that's harvestable, and anything below that isn't. They're keyed to differing levels of productivity, with harvest being minimized at very low levels of productivity and harvest being increased at higher levels of productivity. They provide us with the prescriptions for the sharing. They all incorporate the ESA guidelines and have been subjected to biological opinion review by the feds. And as well, they provide us with guidance both on hatchery production and how the hatchery production should be marked. Back up just one sec. This does not provide us with guidance on working with the Colvilles, and you'll hear more about that in later on in the presentation. This is just with the four treaty tribes from the Lower River plus the Shoshone-Bannocks. One of the primary fishery management bodies you'll hear reference to is the USV Oregon TAC. That's the technical arm of USV Oregon. It's an arm that has worked extremely well for many years. This is one difference between USV Oregon and USV Washington, is technical arguments are minimized in USV Oregon. The policy disputes are held at the policy level by the policy folks in USV Oregon. Sometimes in other arenas, the technical forums become the surrogate place where policy battles are fought. We're very fortunate that's not been the case for a long time in the USV Oregon TAC. And so virtually all abundance estimation, all run size updates, all development of the fishery models and everything else is done through a lot of hard technical work that results in a consensus. And this is really the engine that makes USV Oregon work. Should have mentioned as well that all parties are not just represented, but all parties are very active participants in TAC. Pacific Fishery Management Council, we're not going to spend a lot of time on this because it is primarily managing the fisheries outside, and our focus will quickly become just the inside fisheries. But just a reminder here that Columbia River stocks are a very important component of particularly the Washington ocean fisheries. And so the status of the Columbia River stocks is a key issue that the council grapples with every year as they put together the ocean salmon fisheries. I believe you're all aware then as well that we use, well, first just a quick graphic just to give you a sense of the importance. And as you can see off the Washington-Oregon coast, and in this case it really mostly reflects Washington, how much of that circle is green, that's the Columbia River fish. As you go further north, you can see that the importance of the Columbia River fish is still very large, but it not as large as our own fish are to us. A key part of making the Pacific Council work in concert with our inside management schemes is what we call the North of Falcon process. I believe you're all fairly familiar with it, but without the North of Falcon process, we'd have a much harder time making certain that the ocean fisheries and the inside fisheries are together jointly achieving first our conservation goals, but as well our treaty-non-treaty sharing objectives. We do this concurrently. It's a very important activity for the Columbia River. In recent years, we've begun to broaden the North of Falcon activity in the Columbia. Formerly, it was just focused almost entirely on lower river stakeholders and lower river fisheries. In recent years, the upriver stakeholders have begun to indicate a much greater desire to participate, and so we've begun holding North of Falcon meetings upriver as well as our traditional lower river meetings, and those have become very productive meetings, very useful. We've also begun to take advantage of having all the stakeholders in the room to plan fisheries that aren't as closely associated with the Pacific Council, such as our spring Chinook fisheries, our steelhead fisheries, and our summer Chinook fisheries. Salmon Commission, quick overview here. Just a reminder that we've been working under the Salmon Commission and Salmon Treaty since 1985, and that one of the key stocks that the Salmon Commission deals with is Chinook. This is the forum where we're most certain that some of our far north migrating stocks in particular that get impacted as strongly in Southeast Alaska fisheries and Canadian fisheries as in domestic fisheries. This is the place we look to ensure the basic conservation framework is in place for some of those far north migrating stocks. Again, just a sense here of the distribution in the ocean, both of our fish, and you can see by the term far north migrating, meaning well up into the Gulf of Alaska, and then the number of jurisdictions that those fish cross as they move through the ocean. The compact, as I described earlier, that's congressional legislation that allows us to jointly regulate interstate commerce. The compact works through consensus between the two states, and it provides us then with the ability to achieve concurrent jurisdiction, but also it's good government. This way we don't have that intolerable situation of different regulatory authorities, different regulatory frameworks on two sides of a very difficult to find boundary that wiggles and waggles down the river and doesn't always follow common sense. It's rarely the middle of the river. It's almost always one side or the other, sometimes surprisingly so. So for the average stakeholder, either commercial or recreational fisher, to know which side of the river they're on at any given point and follow a different set of rules would be extremely difficult. So we put a lot of work into ensuring first and always that our joint agreements achieve our joint management objectives, but secondly, that to the greatest extent possible, we minimize the disparity in rules between the two sides. Finally, a picture. Unfortunately, it's probably the ugliest group of humans you could find. But anyway, just to give you a sense of the history of the compact, there's in the middle, there's myself and Steve King, now retired from the state of Oregon. But Steve's career spanned the entire fall and then rise again of summer Chinook. You'll hear a bit more about that later. And then on either side, the two current compact designees. And these are the folks who directly represent Phil and Roy Ellicker from Oregon, and that's Guy Norman and Steve Williams. Just to give you a sense then of the activity at the compact level, and again, you'll hear a lot more about this in some of the further things, but there's some time periods when the compact is really busy, when there's one or sometimes even two meetings a week in order to manage the fisheries within this overlapping set of very tight constraints. As you can see, we're in kind of in between seasons right now, just transitioning out of spring and getting ready for the summer fisheries. And then we've got the very busy fall season coming at us. That's the end of my portion of the presentation, sort of the overview and some of the context. So any more questions on that before we turn it over to Cindy and begin to dissect the Columbia River structure a little more?
Bill, you reminded, refresh my memory about the Simon system reports that you would do on the Columbia, I mean on the compact. We can never keep up with it.
Just. Yeah, those were, I definitely remember hearing some complaints about it. It usually sounded like I had a Mack truck on either side of me as I was trying to send you a message about what had happened at each compact.
Okay, thanks.
So this is Celilo Falls, by the way. Pre-inundation.
So I'm going to talk about fishery management, a little bit about the annual cycle, how we do forecasts, and various tools we use, just kind of across all the fisheries. The management cycle starts off with preseason forecasts by the Technical Advisory Committee. We meet with our advisor groups. We have two advisor groups on the Columbia River. They're joint advisor groups with the state of Oregon. There's about 18 or so members in each group with a lot of different interests and experience, and we get a lot of really good input from them on designing our fisheries. So we meet with them, then we have a compact or a joint state hearing where we get input from the other public, monitor the runs and fisheries in season, and then modify the fisheries as needed. And the next one is just kind of a pictorial of forecasting the run up in the upper right corner, figure out how many fish there are to catch, set our fisheries, monitor catch and run sizes in season. And then the one that kind of circles back around, that's really like a little whirlpool in actuality. We do a lot of circling back on that one. And then adjust fisheries, and then run reconstruction is kind of putting it all together at the end. This one is just kind of to show the presence of the different species, but also to highlight that there's some significant overlap. For instance, on the very bottom, sturgeon are present in the Columbia year-round. The other significant one is steelhead. There are always steelhead in the Columbia River. And there's only one ESU of all the steelhead that are not listed. So, you know, if you're in the water, there's a listed fish in the water with you. The other thing, during the summertime frame, you can see shad, sockeye, and summer chinook all overlap, and plus steelhead. So just adds to the complication. Our preseason forecast, the Technical Advisory Committee that Bill talked about is really the body that does most of the forecasting for most of the major runs. And the good part of that is there's a lot of mix of experience and expertise in the group. We do work on a consensus basis, and so it's real hard to get bias from a particular organization when we do these forecasts. So they're age-based relationships, which means we use the youngest aged fish to try to predict the next age class. And with Chinook, we have ages from 2 through 6. So the 2s predict the 3s, the 3s predict the 4s, 4s predict the 5s. And we do that for each stock or stocker management group. And then we add them all together to get the total return. There is some error with the forecast. It's often larger when we have the extreme data points, meaning record spring Chinook jacks, for example, that we saw a couple years ago. More jacks than we'd ever seen before in history, and just so far off the charts that it didn't line up with anything. That's when we get some of our biggest errors when we do our forecasts. And then, so we use the preseason forecasts for mostly for our early fishery planning, because once the fish, most of the fish start crossing over Bonneville Dam, then we have some other tool for telling us what the run is. So the preseason forecasts are not as critical if our run updates can be made in a timely manner. And that sometimes is the case and sometimes isn't. This is just an example of our age-based database that we use for predicting, and it just shows you that, you know, you have age 2 through 6. This is upriver Bright Falls Chinook. And so we have a lot of data. Most of our Falls Chinook databases go back to 1964 return year, so we have quite a few years to work from. And then this graph is just an example of an actual relationship that we used this year. It's predicting upriver Bright age 3-year-olds on the left and from the age 2-year-olds on the bottom. And it's a pretty good relationship. And this is our preferred method to do it this way. If we don't have a very good relationship, we may be stuck with using some averages or average proportions or something. This is an example of the error in our forecast for upriver spring Chinook. And pretty much what I get from this one is that when we overpredict big. And when we underpredict, it's within about 25% on average. And you can see, it is updated through to 2011, but you can see just these recent year in recent history are where those big ones are, because two or three of those years were those record jacks that we hadn't seen in the past. And we've been working on.
Before you move on, could you go back? I remember discussing this quite a bit in 2007, 2008, when we were coming up with our policy. And didn't you provide us with the errors for all of the different runs when you were doing the briefing back in 2007? I'd like to see the errors for the other species, just to see if there's something particularly difficult about predicting Chinook. The other thing I think we talked about in those days was the run timing changes, too, that make in-season management really difficult. So just as a general professional judgment, do you think spring Chinook is particularly difficult to predict nowadays, or is it all of the Columbia River species that have become difficult? And are the run timings different for all of the species? What do you think?
I think that predicting upriver spring Chinook is more difficult than other species. We have a much better track record on fall Chinook, for example. And fall Chinook, when I say fall Chinook, you know, we're talking about five or six different stock groups and, you know, four different age classes. Our track record is good on fall Chinook. Coho is a little iffier. Summer Chinook is okay. What else am I missing? Steelhead we're real good on. They're pretty stable, though. I don't know what's going on with these upriver spring Chinook. Actually, I mean, one thing that could be likely playing into it, these are all the fish that are destined to return to areas above Bonneville Dam. So we're talking a huge area there's probably 15 or more different hatcheries. It includes the entire Snake Basin, so it also includes the summer Chinook in the Snake. So you have that spring-summer mix. It includes the upper Columbia, and so and then it includes mid-Columbia. So you have a mix of, you know, hatchery and wild fish, listed and unlisted fish, endangered and threatened fish. So there's just a and then you have fish that have to travel 8 dams, and then fish that only have to travel 1 dam. So I think that kind of mix is probably what's adding to some of the complexity. However, you know, previous to recent years, I mean, if you go back to 2001 and go backwards, we didn't do that bad, just that 1 year. I mean, the error was mostly an underprediction. So why are things changing so much now? There's a lot more fish in the run than there was back then. But I think it's more a lot of just the complexity. And then the other question was about run timing. Run timing has changed. Why? I don't know.
For all this?
For spring Chinook, mostly. They've shifted later. And at least in their timing over Bonneville Dam. Let me clarify that. Because in most years, they are in the lower river being harvested in our fisheries at a normal time. Now, there's annual variations, but for the most part, they're in the lower river, but they're not crossing the dam. As I don't know, sea lions. So the next piece here, preparing fishing plans. So all the, you know, background stuff and the management conservation objectives Bill talked about, those are all built into everything that we do. So now we're at the point where we can look at actually designing fishing seasons. We meet with our advisors. We also go do a lot of this work at the North of Falcon meetings. North of Falcon meetings are focused on fall season fisheries for the Columbia River and a little bit of summer. So based on the preseason forecast, our allowable rates, what should the fisheries look like, we prepare the plans with our constituents based on what the commission policy says and what our constituents want. And we do rely on them a huge amount for structuring the fisheries, our constituents and our advisors. Early season fisheries are planned conservatively in case the runs are less than forecast. If you're too conservative, there is some risk that late season fisheries aren't able to harvest all of the allowed fish, and we do always have significant hatchery surplus in most situations because we're constrained and we can't harvest all of those. We do manage all of our fisheries conservatively, so we generally have a small portion of the harvest that occurs in those early season. So when we update runs, we first look at Bonneville Dam counts and then look at historical run timing. And again, the run timing can be early, late, or normal. And so it's a little bit of a judgment call trying to figure out at what point in the run you are. So, and then the next one slide is... Right, updating the run at Bonneville, adding in the lower river fisheries. We do this about once a week, sometimes twice a week, depending on what the need is for management decisions. We update the fishery catch in season by using cotwire tags or visual stock identification is what we use for spring Chinook. Why do we do in-season management? Because the run size of one or more stocks may be different than the preseason forecast. And our Bill talked about our abundance-based management under USV Oregon. our ESA impact rates or our allowed harvest rates change as the run sizes change. And this happens to us quite frequently, where we start off the year basing our fisheries on the preseason forecast and a certain rate, and then in season the run size will change and the rate changes as well, so we kind of get a double whammy on that. Also, the stock composition of the catch can be different than what we thought it would be, or the run timing can also be different. And then, Miranda, you may have seen this before, but this is just an example of the run timing. This is 2006, the Upriver Spring Chinook at Bonneville Dam, and so the black line is is 10-year average timing. So it's what you would consider a normal timed run. The blue line, which is barely showing on this graph, is what has occurred through April 19th. And based on our forecast,
April 19th?
This 2006. So based on our forecast, we should have had 2,000 fish over the dam at this point in time. And in reality, we had 316. So there's a lot of people going, oh my gosh, what's going on? Did you advance? Okay. And then 50% date, so half the run should be over by now. And we had 4,500 fish. So if we would have updated the run, and this is where we tend to... This is a time frame where we tend to try to look at updating the run. When you know or think you're about halfway there, if we would have done that, go back for a minute. If we would have done the run update at this point, we would have said the run is going to be 9,000. We're halfway done. Well, then you get to the next one on May 6th. Now we're finally starting to see some fish. On average, it's 63%, but we should have had 52,000 if our forecast was accurate, and we're half of that at 28,000. But lo and behold, this was the latest run timing ever, and we actually got 132,000 in the run where we had predicted 88. So we actually got more back. But as you're in the middle of that and all of your fisheries are going on, that's where the frustration from people and panic comes from various areas that, wait a minute, how can you keep fishing, or how can you, you know, anyway, that's, and this is not, I mean, this is was the latest timed run, but it's not unusual to have similar type situations.
Wasn't this year similar to that?
This year was very similar to that, yes.
With a big spike?
Yes.
1 point, yeah.
But because we manage our fisheries very conservatively, and despite our forecast not being accurate or not knowing exactly what the run timing is, we have still been able to comply with our ESA requirements very well over the years. This is showing 2001 through 2011. On the left is the actual ESA impact rate for all the non-Indian fisheries. And on the right is what the allowed rate is. And you can see that we were over in two out of those 11 years. And in 04, we just missed by a little bit. And in most years, we're significantly under the limit. And then to wrap up my section on this piece here, this is our run reconstruction, which is basically adding up all the fish that were caught, adding up the fish that were returned to hatcheries or natural spawning areas, and by age and by stock group, figuring out how many we got, and that's the information we use for the preseason forecast the next year. And I can move on to the next section if you're ready.
Yeah, we went through that pretty quickly. You're not asking many questions, commissioners.
ourselves.
Okay. We'll get into more of the nitty-gritties, I think, So we can just go on.
So now I'm going to talk about some of the tools we use for managing our fisheries, and I'm mostly referring to main stem below McNary. We use catch quotas, selective fisheries, different types of selective fisheries, and we have sanctuaries in place. We have commercial sanctuaries at the river mouths, all of the salmon-producing river mouths, and our sport sanctuary, fishing sanctuaries are primarily just below fish ladders or fish entrance areas. And this kind of goes back to where we were a little bit ago, which is two different management approaches. And the first one is an example of managing for an escapement goal, which is how we did things prior to ESA management, which basically says your run size is 100,000, you need 40,000 for your spawning needs, so that means you can catch 60,000. And this is the way we do it currently for summer Chinook. It's the only species that we're doing that currently for. But because of ESA, we're doing a harvest rate-based approach, which says your run size is 100,000, but your allowable rate of harvest is 12%, so your harvestable number is 12,000 instead of 60,000. So that's the comparison. Without ESA constraining the fishery, there would be 60,000 fish to harvest, but because of ESA, there's only 12,000. We use catch quotas for managing many of our fisheries. Sometimes these are stock-specific within. So, for example, the Buoy 10 fishery, we might expect a catch of 10,000 fish, but of that 10,000, 1,000 of them would be an ESA-listed fish that we're primarily concerned about. So as we manage the fishery, because we do cut-wire tag analysis in season, we can know what the stock composition is. We would possibly close the fishery if they catch the 1,000 fish and not necessarily the 10,000 fish. So this is confusing to anglers because, you know, we will say, okay, well, we think that the fishery is going to catch about 10,000 fish. Well, that's based on all of our assumptions about the run sizes and the stock mix within that fishery. But if the stock mix or the run size is different and we catch the 1,000 fish before we catch the 10, then we have to close early. But it's hard to get that concept out because most people just look at, well, we have a 10,000 fish quota and that's what we get. But inside the Columbia, it doesn't work that way. We estimate our sport fisheries with catch and effort counts and our commercial fisheries by landings, and the tribal fisheries uses both tools. So selective fisheries are used to minimize the take or the mortality of wild or ESA-listed fish, minimizes bycatch, and is used to maximize harvest of the hatchery fish or the target stocks. And here's two examples of selective fisheries. The most familiar one to folks is a marked selective fishery, which just means that you release a fish that is marked in a certain way, and it's basically where we have fisheries that just keep hatchery fish. We also have time, area, and gear selectivity where we use the fisheries. We manage the fisheries by time, by in certain areas, or using different gears to minimize impacts to a certain stock or species. And this is an example of that. In the commercial fishery, The bars on the left show the CPUE for Chinook and Coho using a small mesh gill net. And so you can see that using a small mesh gill net, your CPUE is much, much greater for Coho as the target species. And then when you use the large mesh gear, you're reducing your Coho catch and increasing your Chinook catch. So that's an example there. In this...
Commissioner Schmidt has a question.
Cindy, I'm back on the management approach. I was thinking maybe this would come out, but it's really an important formula where you determine the harvest rate-based management. That's the run size times the percent allowable. And that's my question. That 12% is important to both conservation and management or harvest. Who makes that? When is it made? Where does the 12% come from?
It comes from all those things that Bill talked about. Primarily, sorry, it's in our USV Oregon management agreement. There's a harvest rate schedules for all the different species, and I showed you, I didn't show that one yet. Sorry. So for spring Chinook, we have a schedule with all the run sizes and the harvest rates. And so all you have to do is look at your run, and it tells you what your harvest rate is. And it increases and decreases.
Commissioner, we lots of times it ends up being sort of an iterative process to get the numbers right so that they fit into everything else. The harvest managers will propose a certain set of numbers, and NIMFs and some of their technical teams that do a lot of this all-age integration will run those at the same time. They're also running the hydro mortalities, and as they're running what the assumptions are in the salmon recovery plans for the watersheds about what the effects of habitat improvements will be, and then you load in your assessment of the hatchery risks and where you're going to take those, whether you're going to be able to reduce those, and see if all those add up to keeping the stock on what we call the recovery line. And if it gets it into the zone, then that set of numbers looks good. But if it's over some, the team will report that back, and we'll know then that we're not going to get a biological opinion from NIMS that says, yeah, those harvest numbers are okay, because they're clearly not compatible with the others. And so then comes the judgment, well, do we really want these harvest numbers? If so, is there something more we can do with the hatchery risks to work at aggressively reducing those? Is it likely there'll be any further reductions in hydro? No, looks like we've got to go back and rework the harvest numbers. So it's that sort of iterative approach, and that's what's going on in between all the different biops. And then ultimately those result in biological opinions from National Marine Fisheries Service that say, yes, given all these other hydro mortalities and our best estimates of those through these biological opinions, these harvest ones look like they should work in terms of achieving our recovery objectives and not jeopardizing them.
Is the ocean fishery under the same percentile? I would assume so.
Yes. Not always technically. Often the tables themselves and the guidance themselves are independent, but when we do the analyses, all those are taken into account, all the forms of harvest. So there is a biological opinion for the latest Chinook annex of the Pacific Salmon Treaty, for instance.
Thank you.
Commissioner Perry.
Thank you. In your run size estimate, do you take into consideration ocean conditions, temperature, food supply, where some of these fish have been caught, maybe in other parts of their journey north? Are these factors considered also?
We're starting to do a lot more of adding the environmental type variables into our predictions. We have incorporated those into our spring forecast. The rest of our stocks are still just fish in the Columbia in the formulas. We have not included other outside things.
But we, for years, have incorporated the final decisions by the Pacific Fishery Management Council and the final best estimates of what the harvest under the Pacific Salmon Treaty will be in what we call the river mouth run size for the fall fisheries in particular. We've always accounted for what the planned ocean fisheries will look like. And that's done through the Norfolk Falcon process.
Yes, we do account for the harvest of the stocks in the ocean fisheries.
Yeah, I just wondered if fish that were caught off of Vancouver Island or something like that would be any help in your prediction of what would be coming back to the Columbia, what the rate of catch of those fish and so forth.
It is a factor if it's abnormal, is when we more pay attention to it. So generally, it's basically accounted for in our river mouth returns. Yeah.
Thank you.
So we're going to be, let's see, we're on 56. Yeah. We're going to be presenting angler trips values and ex-vessel values, and just wanted to note that they're not directly comparable. And the angler trip values that we've used here have been multiplied by $58. The ex-vessel values are averages over the course of the commercial fisheries. And for fall Chinook, we've combined the bright and the tule fish, which have different values. So it's not a perfect, but it's an overview. And then now I'm going to talk about fishery sampling. We sample all of our fisheries, sport, commercial, tribal. We sample them in the main stem Columbia, in the select areas, that's the safe, and in the tributaries, we go from the mouth upstream to Wells Dam and up into the Snake up to the boundary waters. We collect a lot of information, weight, sex, scale samples, length, marks, scars and bites. The scars and bites are like seal bites and seal scrapes, skin color. We collect cotowire tags, pit tags, DNA samples. Not all fisheries, not all species, but these are some of the things we collect. We do catch and effort estimates in the sport fishery, landings in the commercial fishery, and onboard monitoring in the commercial fishery provides numbers of fish handled. The next slide shows talks about the onboard monitoring. We're currently doing this only in the springtime during the commercial fishery. It requires a budgetary commitment. And it has been occasionally done during summer and fall seasons. Oregon Fish and Wildlife had some funding a year or so back and did a little bit of onboard monitoring in other fisheries. The sport fishery below Bonneville, we manage all of our fisheries cooperatively below McNary with Oregon Fish and Wildlife. And so Oregon actually flies the river. That's a picture of the plane that was used at one point. And the sampler in the right-hand corner that actually counts anglers and boats. And we do this by river section, conduct about 80 midday flights a year during February through October, one weekend and one weekday per week. And the model that estimates the sport catch incorporates tide, weather, water, and water conditions. This is a slide showing the 10 river sections that the sport fishery is divided into. And so section number one is up by Bonneville Dam. I think one of the points I want to bring up on this is that we also divide the catch and effort. We divide the catch and effort into these sections. For example, if you have a high catch rate in section 7, that catch rate is only applied to the anglers in that section. And so if section 7 is the hot spot, but there's only 3 people fishing, and section 10 is got 100 people fishing, but they're not catching anything. Anyway, each piece is added together to get our total catch estimate. And then we also do creel sampling at the boat ramps and the bank fishing areas, gathering information about what river section they're in, how many people in the party, how long you've been fishing, did you catch, did you release? And then Oregon Fish and Wildlife does a boat survey weekly throughout the year to supplement. A non-Indian commercial fishery, we sample at the major buyers. Basically, a lot of the same information as in the sport fishery. We do use the average weight that we sample to estimate the total landings. We apply our average weight from our sampling to the total number of pounds that are reported, and that's how we get our numbers. We take scale samples to get the age composition, coda wire tags to get stock composition, and the landings are reported within 24 hours to the agencies. This map shows that in the commercial fishery, as the blue highlighted section, we have five different zones that we break it up into. And then just showing you commercial sampling in non-Indian fisheries, safe fisheries, and treaty Indian fisheries. I just want to touch a little bit on the treaty Indian fishery. It's conducted with set nets, gill nets, set gill nets, drift gill nets, hoop nets, and hook and line. Most of the treaty fishery is conducted with set nets that don't move or drift. The tribal staff estimates the total effort with weekly flights, and they also expand that based on interviews. So their program is very similar to our sport creel program, where they fly and count the nets, then they sample at the landing areas to get total catch estimates, and then our staff and ODFW staff sample the buyers, the major buyers.
Commissioner Duvia?
Thanks, Madam Chair. City, how accurate is the tribal forecast or catch?
Most of the fish in most of the seasons is sold to a licensed fish buyer. And we have, they're required to report. We have, you know, actual paper. So we can directly compare the fish buyer with the catch estimate, and for the most part they're reconcilable. They go together, they match. So I think fairly accurate.
50%, 70%, 90%.
Well, it's hard to say because there's no way to really truth it out because there's no absolute. For instance, in our sport fishery, you could compare our estimates with punch cards, and when we've done that, we found the punch cards that overestimate, and so we think our creel is better. So there's no absolute to compare with the tribal fishery, except that the fish that are sold to the buyers. And because most of them are sold, and we get an accounting of most of them, and our numbers are very close to the tribal estimate, I think for the most part they're fairly accurate.
And how does that number tie into the catch balancing?
It is the number that's used for catch balancing, the number that's estimated by the tribes.
So we take their estimate for it.
Yeah, like they take ours for our fisheries.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Cindy, do the tribes also account for their take-home fish / CNS fish?
Yes.
What about sales by treaty tribal members along the road? Is that legal, and how is that accounted for?
It is legal. It's accounted for in the same way. So so they fly the river, count the nets, get the effort, go and interview as they're offloading their fish at the beach. So they're getting them before they're taking them to sell. So those two things together should give you the total estimate. count the effort, and then get the catch. Now, once they have taken their fish out of the boat, they either go sell them to a licensed buyer, they sell them to one of us, a public, or they take them home. But they're already accounted for when they're doing the interview at the landing spot. That multiplied times the number of nets is what gets the estimate. And the blue section is where the treaty fishery occurs from Bonneville to McNary Dam. This is just some of the sampling statistics from Lower River Fisheries. We try to sample at least a minimum of 20%, and this is just showing some numbers from our various fisheries from 2008 to 2010. And that's it for that section.
Okay, any other questions? Commissioner Carpenter?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bill, I have a request, if I may, if it's appropriate, Chair and Phil, to deal with Commissioner Perry's question. Could it be possible when we take a break to get a copy of the most recently completed model as it relates to North of Falcon? To show the fellow commissioners the Alaska catch, the BC catch, where are those stocks, how they work into the model. I'm not expecting we're going to have a full-blown model discussion, but just so these gentlemen have seen them and understand how the process works a little bit.
Yes, we...
Trying to figure out where...
And lady, my apologies.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
We can do that.
Okay. Okay, I think we want to continue on till about 3 and then take a break. Okay.
Okay, well, we're going to start walking through the fisheries, and we had a request that you wanted to start with summer Chinook, and so.
Director Anderson?
Sorry. I know you were. You were observant that the other commissioners had asked a lot of questions, and I think Commissioner Mankin indicated he was keeping a list. Is that right? Is that what everybody's doing? I have a couple of things, but I don't want to. I had two things, but I don't want to. If you want to wait till the end, that's
fine. I think I can wait till the end. Yes.
Okay. Do you want to go ahead? Couple questions.
Sure. Give people a break. Back on, and you don't necessarily have to go back to this slide. But back on slide 26, and the slide was entitled Columbia River Compact. It's my page numbers are a little hard to read, but the slide numbers are clear. And the title of the slide was Columbia River Compact, and under the third bullet it says Fishery Decision Making Authority. And under that heading, the second bullet said, this is relative to the Columbia River Compact. This compact is comprised of Washington and Oregon commissions that have delegated to directors or designees of WDFW or ODF&W. And that is, that's not accurate. As it's pointed out in the delegation of authority, in Washington, I can't speak to Oregon, but RCW 7775010 provides that the director of the department represents the state of Washington on the Columbia River Compact. And in the delegation of authority document, it cites that and then goes on to say, and shall consult with the Fish and Wildlife Commission. So just wanted to, in case there was any misunderstanding about what's in the statute versus what was represented on the slide.
I think that is the case in Oregon, though, that the commission. Sorry.
whatever it is in Oregon. And there was this question, the second thing is there was this question a moment ago and the response about how we're accounting for catch in state fisheries, treaty fisheries, and your response about, well, there's no absolute amount, an amount that we have 100% certainty in to compare the catch estimate to. And I can either put this in the form of a question or a statement, but it's my belief that we don't have an absolute number in any of the fisheries. We don't have it in the treaty fishery. We don't have it in the recreational fishery because we don't have 100% sampling, and we don't have it in the commercial fishery. We know what comes to the dock, but if there are fish released, we have some information that we may get from interviews, but we don't have an absolute accounting for the total mortalities in any of the fisheries to make that kind of comparison.
Commissioner Mencken?
Yeah, so as long as the director brought up that one question with regards to the compact, I guess one of the questions I have, and within the philosophy of the policy of this commission and within your delegation of authority, can you explain the process if the compact does not come to a consensus on an issue?
Then we would not be able to have concurrent regulations. It would revert back to each state enacting its own regulations for their portion of the river that is within their jurisdiction. And we would then lose the concurrent authority, enforcement authority as well.
So in some respects, was that not the way it operated last time when this commission had a different opinion? And as to what should happen in the fishery than the Oregon Commission?
We didn't get to a point where we didn't have concurrent regulations. So we were operating under a consistent set of regulations. Therefore, we had the concurrent, or we had the enforcement authority on either side to enforce our respective regulations regardless of where we were in the river. Okay. So we have not gotten to that point.
Okay.
I wanted to make an observation too about why the commission might be kind of quiet. I've been looking through the slides, and the slides get more packed with information as you get deeper into them. So I'm actually pretty happy that we're moving pretty quickly through these initial general slides. So I don't want you to feel like you have to ask questions. I like the pace, so let's keep going.
All right, well, now we're going to talk about specific fisheries. We're going to basically move from the mouth upriver and starting with summer season fisheries and talking about below Bonneville Dam, sport and commercial, Bonneville to Priest, and then the upper Columbia and the various fisheries. And we're going to show you maps as we move along to help you get oriented. Thank you. So we're going to start with fisheries below Bonneville Dam. That little black line is Bonneville Dam in this graph that's falling off the river there. So starting off with our conservation objectives for summer management, we have ESA listed steelhead, snake, and upper Columbia, and I forgot to put in mid-Columbia steelhead also should be on that list, and we have Snake River sockeye. We have an upper Columbia management agreement on summer Chinook, also an agreement with the Colville tribe on management of summer Chinook. We have the commission policy which on summer Chinook, which allocates between sport and commercial fisheries downstream of Priest Rapids Dam. So our management approach, we use marked selective sport fisheries for summer Chinook. We use large mesh commercial fisheries to avoid steelhead, And we also use the marked selective spore fisheries to help us extend that season longer. So looking at fisheries below Bonneville Dam, basically summer Chinook fisheries were closed in the 60s and early 70s, and just reopened in the year in beginning in about 2000 in the Upper Columbia first, and then sport below Bonneville in 2002 and commercial in 2005. So these fisheries all are targeting non-listed Upper Columbia summer Chinook, all destined to go above Priest Rapids Dam. Your policy guidance says to meet the conservation requirement, which is our current escapement goal is 20,000 fish. The sport fishery above Priest Rapids Dam is the highest non-Indian fishing priority, so more of the allocation goes up there. And then the commercial fishery is allocated 50% of the allowable below Priest Rapids Dam. Fisheries occur during June 16th to July 31. And I just wanted to note that the escapement goal is currently under review in USV Oregon. In fact, they're discussing it today and tomorrow. WDFW has proposed some new escapement goals for naturally spawning summer Chinook in the Wenatchee, Methow, Okanagan, Similkameen, and some other minor areas. Also, Chief Joe Hatchery is going to come online and start collecting broodstock beginning next year. So in our current USV Oregon management agreement, there's a piece in there that says when Chief Joe comes online, we'll look at the escapement goals again because we want to provide broodstock for the hatchery program. So we, as an agency, said, let's take advantage of that. Let's review our own natural spawning escapement goals and see if we can get some. As we're changing goals, let's do them all. I don't know how that's going to end up, but I just wanted to bring that up.
Commissioner Mencken?
I'm assuming that they're talking about increasing the escapement goal. Is that the
priority? Yes. Well, actually, yes for natural spawning, but the hatchery goal is actually about the same, even though they increased production out of Chief Joe, because the PUDs recently went through a recalculation of their mitigation responsibilities, and so based on that new updated calculation of, you know, number of eggs per female and survival and all those things, their actual needs went down. If that's making sense. So the hatchery goals are going to be about the same as it currently is, but we're going to get more fish produced. But the natural goals are the ones that we're recommending go up.
Okay.
And I assume that's temporary until the hatchery is producing and can collect its own broodstock?
No, because the we're looking for mostly wild buck.
Or native stock,
yeah.
Okay.
Commissioner Duvia.
Thanks, Madam Chair. In the first part of your slide there, what were the events that triggered the sports reopening in 2000 and the event in 2002 and the event in 2005 for commercial?
We started getting significant improvement in our summer Chinook returns beginning in the early 2000s. And that was a result of several things, increased production and supplementation programs in the Upper Columbia, improved passage survival through the hydro system, and they had a real good ocean to go to when they did that. So the returns were from the 60s, in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, there was about 20,000 summer Chinook that returned in a year, just average. It was real stable, didn't increase, but just around 20,000. And beginning in 2000, it jumped up and we've had, you know, 60, 70, 80,000 in the 2000s. So the Upper Columbia, because they were, so they took advantage of it first. They saw the opportunity, knew that there was fish to catch. In the lower river, we were on, we still had Snake River Summer Chinook in our mix, which were under the ESA listed fish at that time. So we couldn't access those Summer Chinook at the same rate or time as those other fish. In 2005, through USV Oregon, we said we're going to change our cutoff date on Summer Chinook, and so the management time frame is going to be June 16 to July 31. During that time frame, if we fish, we are only fishing on Upper Columbia non-listed Summer Chinook. So when we move that time frame, that's when it freed us up to have fisheries focused on Upper Columbia Summer Chinook and not ESA fish. Fishing prior to that, and so that's kind of what ties in with the, we had some limited sport fisheries first in 2002, and then reopened commercial in 2005.
In 2002, did you take some of the upper river allotment for catch and put it in the lower river, or did you have a net increase?
There really wasn't an allocation at that time, except the, I'm not remembering when our...
Commissioner, since these were brand new fisheries, they weren't catching anywhere near the allowable harvest. Particularly in the first couple of years, I mean, you're talking about reopening fisheries in areas that had not been fished for salmon in literally 40 years. And so it took the anglers in the upper river several years to really learn how to key in where the fish hold up, what techniques work best, and all that. So there was no issue in terms of the escapement goal. For several years in a row, the spawning escapements were well in excess of the goals. And so there was no need to provide allocation guidance because nobody was bumping up against any of their allocations. We did open up upriver first. Two other reasons other than the one Cindy mentioned were, first off, after that many decades, you want to make sure those fish are there before you fish on them. And so even though the forecast looked really good, we were only willing as staff to open fisheries after we'd actually counted the fish through a couple of dams, and we knew for sure that they had actually made the turn and were headed for the Upper Columbia and not for the Snake, for instance. So that was part of it. It was just a basic precaution. You don't want to make a mistake after you've held the fishery closed for 40 years. And then the second reason was just a sense of, when you look at the state and look at which area had had the fewest fisheries for the longest, the Upper Columbia was the obvious one in terms of salmon fisheries, because these always were sort of the predominant fish. And so, again, just from a standpoint of an area that's had the least amount of opportunity. And so those two factors obviously fit together. But the foremost one was just the staff was not going to recommend an opener on a run like that until after those fish had been physically counted, heading to the point where you knew where they were headed and you knew how many you had.
And what was the event in 2005 that opened up the commercial sign?
That was commission guidance. At that point, we knew, as we were contemplating the full suite of fisheries, we knew we couldn't proceed any further without allocation guidance from the commission.
I've looked at, you know, talked about this before. I was told or understood it, we tried to start a test fishery that the director put in place to see what the impact would be.
Commissioner, you might be right by a year.
I don't think the commission...
might be 2006 instead of 2005, and you may be correct about that for 1 year.
So what has been the harvest since 2000? Has it been... is it increasing? Can you give us any idea of the size?
I'm going to do that here. But first, I'm going to talk about the sport fishery. on Summer Chinook below bottom of the dam.
Madam Chair.
Oh, sorry, Commissioner Perry. Now the questions are flowing. Okay. Oh, Commissioner Mencken.
Yeah, going back to that same issue, when this fishery was once again opened up, was it classified as an experimental fishery?
Not that I recall. I don't know why it would be. I don't recall that.
Commissioner Perry?
You indicated that the Chief Joe Hatchery would be coming online next year, and they would need rootstock. Where would that rootstock come from? And does it make a difference where it comes from relative to the success of the fishery? And how will the fish being produced at this Chief Joe Hatchery, how will they fit into this entire framework that you've been talking about?
So they're going to be Okanagan fish that are headed for the Okanagan, Canada, places north. I'm going to get into this a little bit later. I'll talk a little bit about the Colville's fishery, but just to very quickly answer your questions, that's where they're going to come from. They're going to remain wild brood stock to maintain the integrity of the stock upstream. And there was a third thing you'd ask there.
I just wondered, if you're going to talk about it later, yeah. I'll just wait.
We'll get into it in a little more detail.
Very good.
Madam Chair.
Director Anderson.
In response, or adding on to the answer to Commissioner Mankin's question, I believe, I don't have the statute language in front of me, but I believe that the commercial fishery for Summer Chinook could have fit under the emerging commercial fishery statute in that there was an absence of that fishery for the length of time that you saw on that graph a moment ago. However, it was not. It was not managed as an emerging commercial fishery. However, I think the statute would have allowed it if that decision had been made.
Okay. So sport harvest below Bonneville Dam for Summer Chinook. The average from 2002 to 2011 is 2,500. The largest was last year in 2011 at 5,200. This is just below Bonneville Dam. And then the next slide shows angler trips below Bonneville Dam. And I just need to tell you that 01 was just a steelhead angler trips because we weren't open in 01 for Summer Chinook. So that was a mistake of me putting that on there. So 01 is just steelhead angler trips. The steelheads open during this time frame. So angler trip average during this time of 02 to 011, 49,600. And then you can see the angler trip value there of just under 3.8 million. Now the next one, here's the commercial harvest, and it still has some of goes back to 60. I looked that up today, and those 1960 and 62, those were actually the highest harvests that this fishery had seen, 40 to 48,000. But in recent years, the average 04 to 11 is 2,800. Last year was the biggest at 5,000. And then the ex-vessel value average for 09 to 11 is about 215,000. And now I'm going to move upstream, still talking about Summer Chinook, and we have our main stem fishery from Bonneville to McNary open for Summer Chinook, and that sport harvest is shown in this next graph. It's a much smaller fishery, at least for Summer Chinook, and this is averaged about 330 fish.
Commissioner Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to go back to slide 75, if I may, and 77. And you made an economic analysis in 77. No economic analysis for what you stated on slide 75?
It's on the slide 76, on the angler trips. It's on the next slide. It's on the angler trip slide.
Yeah, well, I don't know that that's apples and apples, but I'll get into that later.
I did have a slide up front that was sort of, they're not comparable.
Right, okay.
It was just some way of showing.
Fair enough.
Okay. So moving upstream, here's the harvest. Oh, okay. Bonneville to Priest, 330. Okay, now we're moving to the Upper Columbia. And Jeff's taking over.
Okay. The Summer Chinook fisheries in the Upper Columbia. Is there a question?
And it is going back to slide 76 again. So you said that 2001 was just steelhead. So what we're looking at here is all sports fishing angler trips in that period, not necessarily just associated with the summer Chinook.
That's correct. These are just salmonid trips, though. So it's basically steelhead and summer Chinook trips.
I was just sort of, you know, struck by the little difference between 2001 and 2002 when we added the summer Chinook in. It's basically people are going out to fish for salmon, regardless of what they.
I just want to point out that these are for the upper Columbia, which actually starts kind of at the bend below the shaded area down there. That's where Priest Rapids Dam is. This is mostly a main stem Columbia fishery. There are some tributary fisheries that I'll point out, and there'll be more of those in the future, I think. But most of this harvest takes place in the main stem. Go ahead. It's not quite a marked selective fishery as yet. Our regulations are, they have been at least for the last few years, 3 adults, only one of which can be a wild fish, an unmarked fish. That's because those fish have been available. We did not need them for escapement. When they're talking about the Chief Joseph Dam kicking in, that's when we know we're going to need every last wild fish up there, not only to make the brood stock for the hatchery, but then also to continue our current escapement numbers. So next year, that's slated to kick in, and it will become a full marked selective fishery. The season starts July 1st. Most places, well, all places, it runs at least through September. Much of the main stem, it'll run into October, and that has to do with whether there's a steelhead present in any numbers that we might impact. As Cindy said earlier, the sport fishery and the Colville tribal fishery have the highest priority in the entire allocation for the river. However, I want to point out that before we get to the harvest slide, the upper river actually has not harvested the total number of available fish, and so we've donated back not only the sport fishery, the recreational fishery, but also the Colvilles have added fish back to the lower river. But I also want to point out that just like the lower river, in the upper river, not only the interest but also the efficiency of the anglers is increasing. And these guys are, I'll point something out when we get into the harvest slide. It's really quite remarkable how quickly they're picking up on this. And I suspect that not in the near future, we will be able to harvest their allocation in the upper river. This is the total production for the upper river. Forget Priest Rapids Hatchery. That shouldn't have been in there. And these, all the production numbers that I give, I'll try to remind you as I go along, these are all the new numbers based on the recalculation that was brought up earlier. So the new PUD numbers, hatcheries that are going to come online like Chief Joe, it's everything that's going to be happening from this point forward. So total summer production in the upper river is going to be 4.5 million fish. 1.4 million of those will be in the main stem. Those Okanagan fish, that's the Chief Joe hatchery portion. The Methow is PUD mitigation. The Wenatchee is PUD mitigation. The Eniat's brand new. They've just started releasing fish in the last year or so. And that's federal mitigation, inundation mitigation. Here's what the harvest has looked like. Started out fairly high. I know it's tempting to look at see the drop in 2005 and think about all those other fisheries kicking in, but there was also some downturns in the run sizes, I believe, and other things that factored into this. I think the most important thing to look at is how the Upper Columbia tracked pretty evenly. We had some low catches in 2009 even 2010. 2010 and 2011 is a comparison I'd really like to point out to you. As so often happens in tributary fisheries or you know, end-of-run fisheries, river conditions make have a tremendous effect. And they do in the lower river, too, I realize. But what happens up in the in this particular fishery, since it's primarily a mainstem fishery, if there's low water conditions and there's a thermal block in the Okanagan and the fish stall in the Wells Pool, that's where they get hammered. And that's what happened in 2010. And so we thought we had a pretty good harvest in 2010 there. In 2011, last year, we had the high water, fast water, cold water, no barrier in the Okanagan. Those fish were shooting right up past there. It was difficult to even fish in the Wells Pool because of the high water. But the anglers adapted very quickly, and they'd already began learning that they could catch these things in below Wells Dam and below Wanapum, which is down near Priest. And while we anticipated maybe a 2,000 or 3,000 fish harvest, we had a better harvest in 2011, almost 5,000 fish. So I think there's good reason to think that we're going to be harvesting as many fish as possible in the near future, even with going totally mark selective.
Commissioner Duvia?
Thanks, Madam Chair. Can you go back to that last slide? It kind of looks to me like in 2005 going forward, the trend changed because we introduced commercial fishing in the lower part of the river, and that difference in catch in the upper river was maybe taken by the commercials.
Yeah, I that might have had some of the effect there. I think we don't have the run sizes for everything, do we? If I remember right, there was a bit of a downturn in the run sizes, though, too, and so it kind of set things back. What I do know is that there has not been a year where allocations cut off the upper river fishery.
Do we have any indication of fishing licenses sold in these various sections of the Columbia as we open it up to sport fishing?
We would have trips. We could tell you how many trips were taking place. And I have some of that in the next slide, but I don't break it down by area, just for what do we have for the upper Columbia.
Okay. Is that graph so we can see what happened?
No, I just have it verbally. I averaged it. I had the numbers, but I didn't put it into a graph form. But we could do that for you. So it's over those, and this is all the way back to 2000, we've averaged 16,000 trips a year, but it's varied between 10,000 and 20,000 angler trips any given year. There's an overlap in these fisheries between the Chinook fishery and the sockeye fishery, which is relatively recent, I'll say. When we creel, we do ask the people what they were fishing for, what their primary species of intent was. Quite often, they're after either one, so it's very hard to pick apart. The way those fisheries run, depending on river conditions and so forth, you can go out, and if you've figured it out and you know what the timing is on the sockeye fishery, you go hit that, then you go fish for summer Chinook. So it's a little hard to pick out. So I've included all the angler trips that happened during the summer Chinook season. I've already talked about the main stem and the difference between the Wells Pool to the Okanagan and then the Wanapum Wells Dam fisheries, but they're going to be, I think in the future, rather than being on a high water year, being in one place, a low water year, the other place, we're going to have big fisheries in all those places. And that's what gives me confidence we're going to take advantage of the allocation. The tributaries I didn't talk about. Bill, could you back up to the harvest graph? Forgot to mention the red in here. Just for comparison, our biggest tributary fishery at this point has been in the Okanagan and Similkameen. In fact, there was a year when only the Okanagan and Similkameen were open. That might have been that 2000. At any rate, you can see the comparison in the actual harvest. The larger number of river miles is actually in the Okanagan, but the higher number of fish is caught in the Similkameen. That's our best fishery for at least the last 2 years running. Okay. We did open up summer Chinook in 2011 in the Wenatchee. Not too many fish were caught in there, and it's only 1 year, so I didn't graph it, but I think that's an up-and-coming fishery. We will have plenty of fish in the Wenatchee for the long-term, I believe, harvestable fish. Chelan Falls is also a new fishery. Those fish used to be released in the main stem at Turtle Rock. It was moved over a couple of years ago to Chelan Falls, which is very near. It's in the same vicinity, but we actually have acclimation ponds there, and so we'll Chelan Falls, in terms of a tributary, is like a quarter mile of fishable water, but what it is going to create is a big bubble fishery in the main stem right there at Chelan Falls, and that'll be yet another place where anglers will be able to take advantage of the fish returning. The Aniat's going to be the same sort of way. There isn't a lot of the Aniat River that's actually going to be open for fishing, but the bubble fishery created outside the mouth of the Aniat will be a very good fishery. And here's the harvest by the Colville tribe. They haven't taken as many fish until recently. They're starting to be able to fish. Again, they're fishing selectively, but they're using quite different gears. They're using a purse seiner. They're trying other gears. They use some hoop nets. They use some seines. They're looking at a floating trap net, and they're this coming year they have an experimental weir that's going to go in I think it's about 8 river miles up the Okanagan at Malotte. But they're affected even more so by because they have a smaller area to fish. The tribal boundary is basically in the Wells Pool, so they're fishing right there at the mouth of the Okanagan with that purse seiner. When the conditions set up that the fish stall again in the Wells Pool, they have good access to those fish, and they're able to capture. And the purse seining, in terms of a selective method of fishing, has worked very, very well for them. So they were planning to get most of their brood stock that way, but recognizing that under different scenarios, different river conditions, if you look at 2011, they barely got over 1,000 fish they were able to capture with that, because the fish didn't hang around and they weren't as accessible as they were for the purse seiner in the past. There was some other question you had, Commissioner Perry. Did I get them all about the tribal fishery?
Yeah, I just wondered, once the Chief Joe hatchery gets into production, how does that group of fish fit into this framework? Will it be just more fish allocated as you guys have outlined, or will it be a special?
Well, I think first and foremost that's going to be true. It's another, I forget what the returns are on that 2 million fish release, but it's pretty hefty. You know, that's almost half of what we're doing right now. So it'll add to all the fisheries in that regard. The main reason, though, of course, this is all about propagating these upper river stocks, and primarily for the Colvilles, that's going to be the Okanagan. That's their reservation boundary, and so they're very interested in that particular stock, and that's why they and we agree. We should include wild fish as the brood stock there. Keep this run as healthy as possible genetically. And there really won't be any reason with the numbers of hatchery returns, at least not in the foreseeable future, to really have to. Once we start to get returns from all these new runs, not only the Chief Joseph hatchery, but the Aniat and some of these others, we shouldn't have to go back to harvesting any of those wild fish, unmarked fish.
Commissioner Schmitten.
Thank you, Chair. Jeff, in the Colville harvest, in the selected fishery, in addition to the purse seines, weren't they planning on putting a weir in the river, in the Okanagan, where they could turn around and then select out very easily? It would be a temporary weir during the summertime.
Yeah.
Is that still in the blueprint? And had it been there, it would have really helped them last year when the fish blew through.
Well,
I'll just give you the other question, you can answer them both. Nothing mentioned about the Methow. Any consideration for summer Chinook fishery in the Methow?
Okay, let's do that tribal stuff first. The weir is going in on an experimental basis this year.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think we've got, at least for an operative plan, we've got most of the kinks worked out of it. They were not intending this year to actually harvest fish there. But they have since proposed, looking at the size of the run and thinking about a contribution that will be well escaped in terms of natural origin fish, and but we're somewhat worried about the influence of hatchery fish in the Okanagan. So depending on how the fishery goes for the Okanagan and the main stem and what's left coming into the Okanagan and how many of those fish, those hatchery fish, we think we need to remove. We may be taking fish out at the weir this year. It wasn't anticipated, but it might be a good move. But last year, given the flows that we saw, they would not have been able to operate that weir. Flows were just too high. And that's going to be kind of the bugaboo, you might say, with the weir and the purse seiner. There'll be years where the purse seiner isn't extremely effective, but they can still operate the weir and get the brood stock there. But there's going to have to be some other methods for those years that are similar to 2011, and the flows are just too high to operate either one of those gears effectively. As far as the methow goes, I don't anticipate a fishery soon. Numbers in the methow aren't all that high, particularly the NORs. I forget the category we have for contributing stock, right? Contributing stock, and I haven't seen what the new escapement numbers are going to be for that. The escapement numbers are lowered for it, but I wouldn't think they would be for a contributing stock, and that we may be able to offer a fishery there.
Chair, one other follow-up. I continue to be asked on a regular basis at the Colville hatchery and the Colville take, they intend to not have commercial sales. Is that accurate?
That's what I've heard.
Do we?
Our management agreement with the Colvilles, under which they conduct their harvest, specifies that the fish are to be taken by Colvilles for subsistence purposes only, for tribal subsistence purposes. And there's no structure for them to license their fishermen to act as individual commercial fishers.
Commissioner Jennings?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just looking again at slide 82 and the total summer production from the hatcheries, a question I have was, do we have concerns about the influence of hatchery fish on our wild stock with this kind of production out there? No, I mean, it's nice to see that we're going in to capture the stuff coming back to this, to the Colville hatchery, but one of the issues we've got is, you know, hatchery escapement onto wild spawning areas. So we
will, of course, be paying very close attention to that. It remains to be seen just how effective these fisheries can be in controlling piehouse, I think, is really what it's going to get down to. Various other places, like in the Wenatchee, we have structures that we can take fish out at. I was going to get to this a little later, but, you know, generally, it's very difficult to conduct adult management like you're talking about without having a fishery first, without giving the public a chance at these fish. And so I think we're going to play it through from that point, from that point of view.
Can you just explain that a little bit further?
Well, I guess I'd also mention, this is something we can go into a lot of detail on, but we held, along with the Colvilles, the Yakimas, National Marine Fisheries Service, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, we held what was called a Summer Chinook Summit, where we looked at both hatchery and natural production throughout the range of the Upper Columbia fish, and on a watershed-by-watershed basis looked at where the production was coming from, looked at what the current information we had on where the hatchery fish were spawning with naturals, and in essence made it an individual determination. This is how we built our new natural escapement goal, was what we'd be able to do in each river to meet the agreed to proportion natural influence as a rolling average. In essence, apply the HSRG principles on a tributary by tributary basis. And we believe we've got a successful plan, and that's what we're moving forward to try to achieve, is our ability to do that. Again, we've got monitoring in place. That's a key component of that, as it is everywhere else. And to the extent that the monitoring indicates we're going to have problems with that in specific areas, we'll go ahead and look at our options for addressing those. But we really have given this a hard look. This looks like it will be compatible with healthy natural production throughout the Upper Columbia of summer Chinook. And we're collecting the data and structuring the fisheries. It's another part of the reason why the Upper Columbia main stem recreational fishery is going selective. The first reason is to assist with Chief Joe Hatchery broodstock, But the other reason is that most years, our framework indicates it'll need to be more selective than it is currently.
I have faith you had a good answer. It's important to get on the record for people.
Yeah. As Bill said, that the entire run was very heavily modeled. And the driver for that really was the same kind of concern that you brought up, Commissioner Jennings, thinking about, well, the Colvilles want to put in Chief Joe Hatchery, and what was that going to mean? There's these other smaller programs, too, like the ENIAT, moving those fish over to Chelan Falls and keeping them from cutting down on the stray rate in the main stem as a whole. All those actions were all contemplated at the same time. There is a very large portion of the Upper Columbia Run, I call it large. We're investigating just how large it is, but there appears to be quite a few main stem spawners that are not accounted for. We still have a quite high number of NORs that are not accounted for in the tributaries. And I had one other thing I wanted to say after thinking about your question, Commissioner Schmitten, about the tribe and commercial sales. They're quite a ways, even now, from still being able to retain enough fish, you know, cold storage, those sort of things, to fulfill all the tribal needs that they have. So I don't think there's going to be anything like that contemplated in the near future.
Commissioner Duvia.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I, too, would echo and heard the comments from Commissioner Schmitten's comment about the commercialization from the Colwells is a major concern in eastern Washington. And so we've tried to reinforce that this is going to be a subsistence fishery for them. And I could personally testify that I had opportunities to buy fish from them last year in Colville, Washington, that were recently taken. So it's not necessarily totally non-commercial. But that fishery is a success and a start already. But there are thousands of fishermen that are talking to me in anticipation of this coming online. So this, as you will go through in your sockeye portion of this thing, is totally revitalizing central and eastern Washington. This is one of the big opportunities and success stories for the department, as well as a lot of communities on the river that have been kind of the shortchanged people. All the fish seems to be stayed below Bonneville. Be nice to have some of those people in Astoria drive to Brewster to fish as we drive from Colville to Astoria to fish. So it's going to be a big help, but I think the sooner and the more fish we can push up, I think the better it will be for a balanced effort across the state. So I'm looking forward to it.
This is the last slide on summer Chinook. It's just a summary. And through 2009 through 2011, we've averaged just under 40,000 fish passing all fisheries and available for escapement. Total sport harvest has been 7,200, and you can see the breakouts of where that was average. Commercial 4,100 and Colville Tribal 1,800.
Okay, I think we can take a break now, but I have to recognize that we've really slowed down, so it's looking like we're not going to make it all the way through this presentation by 5. That's my guess. Wouldn't you agree? There's a lot of information in here, so do some talking with commissioners about what we do if we don't make it all the way through. Another session, perhaps. Okay, let's recess for 10 minutes.